Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A few numbers to help explain our economy on today's show. Is GDP still a useful way to measure how the country is doing? Plus the numbers on diversity in Silicon Valley. And who's actually making the movies we'll watch this summer? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, May 29th, and it's great to have you with us. Well, this morning we got an odd update from the Commerce Department. Here's what it said. I'm going to paraphrase a little bit. Remember when we told you the economy held steady last quarter? Well, about that. It actually shrank by what would be the equivalent of 1% a year. That's kind of weird, right? Because during that time, the unemployment rate fell, and jobless claims also fell, and the stock market did okay. So is there something we're missing? What's wrong with GDP? That's the question. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has the answers.
You may wonder, hey, Bureau of Economic Analysis, how did you just miss the fact that our whole economy shrank last quarter?
When we produced our first estimate last month, we didn't have complete data yet.
Brent Moulton is with the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Why didn't they have complete data? Well, because we didn't get it to them quickly.
Well, these are business surveys, and it takes time to get responses.
And that late data showed businesses had temporarily let their inventories fall after the bad winter. All that aside, it is weird for GDP to fall like this.
It's really rare for GDP to fall at all during an expansion.
That's Chris Lowe with FTN Financial. He says that doesn't mean there's something wrong with GDP as an indicator.
GDP is still probably the best broad measure we have of economic activity.
So then why did it fall when other indicators seemed okay? Again, Brent Moulton.
GDP doesn't answer all questions.
Indicators like jobs and unemployment or the Dow measure jobs and unemployment and the Dow. GDP measures everything produced in the economy.
Basically, all of the market production activities.
It's huge. Think of it as a bus. Have you ever been across the intersection from a bus and it looks like it's coming right at you, right up to the curb, but it's actually just making a really wide turn? It's kind of like that. Chris Lowe says the quarter started out looking bad, but
by March, the numbers were coming in strong again, but at that point, weakness was essentially baked in the cake.
By next quarter, economists say GDP is going to bounce back. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Google released some data on the diversity of its workforce after years of claiming the information was a trade secret. This note accompanied the data. Google said, "We are not where we want to be when it comes to diversity." Where are they? Google is mostly white and mostly male, which makes the company pretty much like every other company in Silicon Valley. Here's Marketplace's Chrissy Clark.
Not long after Ariel Zuckerberg was hired as the senior product manager for a San Francisco startup called Human, she was in a meeting talking about a new feature for their mobile app. She was one of only three women on the engineering team and the only female executive. The app would let you add a contact to your phone just by knocking it while it was in your pocket. And the guys on the team thought this was pretty awesome.
I brought to the attention of the execs that women don't carry their phones in their pocket. They carry it in their purse.
It's the kind of obvious but potentially fatal design flaw that could make an app not that awesome to half of their potential customers, also known as women.
I mean, this was what I know. this made sense to me immediately, but to the execs, it was like, oh, wow, I never thought of that.
Innovation blind spots is what Catherine Bracey calls them. She recruits engineers for Code for America, a tech nonprofit based in Silicon Valley, a place, she says, with little diversity and many blind spots.
You assume that you have all the knowledge you need to solve all these problems. You don't realize that your world is so small. Innovation happens when you have different types of people in a room together having arguments, but coming out with better solutions and better ideas.
In fact, there's lots of research showing that diversity helps a company innovate and profit, says Vivek Wadhwa, a tech entrepreneur and fellow at Stanford Law School.
If technology developers don't understand anything about their audience, how will they develop better technologies?
Because while engineers and executives at Google and other tech companies are mostly white and male, their customers are not. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, those GDP revisions? Details when we do the numbers. week, we're kicking off our new series, Learning Curve, looking at technology in the classroom. Today, our focus is on the future, or the money that's betting on it anyway. Venture capitalists poured more than $500 million into educational tech companies during the first quarter this year. At that rate, they're on track to nearly double what they invested last year. Marketplace's Adrian Hill follows the money.
Education isn't what you'd typically think of as sexy. It's practical, serious, dull even. But now that it's gotten mixed up with technology, venture capitalists are very into it. Michael Moe is CEO of GSV Capital, which has invested $100 million in education technology, companies like online class sites, Coursera, and 2U. He says there's a lot to like about education these days.
Interestingly, for a market that's $2 trillion in the U.S. and $4.5 trillion globally, it is characterized by very few large players.
Today, technology grabs only a slice of that spending. There are big names like Pearson, the textbook company, Google creating new tools for teachers. News Corp has an entire educational division called Amplify. But Mo says that leaves plenty of room for small companies, unheard of companies, to hit big and grow fast.
I think the forces at work could compress that time from idea to mega business in a much shorter period.
One of the companies trying to make the jump to mega business is Remind 101.
Remind 101 provides a safe, free way for teachers to text message students and stay in touch with parents.
Basically, Remind 101 gives teachers the ability to mass text kids and parents. Things like homework assignments, test reminders, notes of encouragement.
I have a bunch of learning disabilities, so I have ADD and I'm dyslexic. I was diagnosed in fifth grade, and school is always really hard for me.
Brett Koff is the co-founder and CEO. In college, he realized reminders like texts could help him get stuff done, could help him stay on track.
I would drool at the thought of going to Silicon Valley. I thought it was some golden place where, like, money just fell off trees, and it doesn't.
Okay, it might not fall off trees, but since 2011, when Koff and his brother got to Silicon Valley, they've raised more than $19 million from investors. Remind 101 is free for teachers. The company says teachers send about 80 million texts a month with it. And the teacher focus is part of the reason it's so attractive to venture capitalists. There's a shift in the education market. The customer is changing.
In the past, the way that innovation came to schools was in a car. A salesman would set up a meeting with a district IT administrator, and in a few weeks' time, the salesman would bring his computer and demo the product to the district decision maker.
That's Jennifer Carolyn. She's managing director of the New Schools Seed Fund, part of the New Schools Venture Fund, a nonprofit philanthropic investment group. Today, she says,
we have teachers discovering apps and tools on the tablets and bringing them into the classroom.
And with millions of teachers out there, word can spread fast. And it does.
When this period of education history is written, it will be the story of the teacher that's driving technology growth in our schools and starting the ed tech companies.
The question now is how much of the money chasing what's next in the classroom is going to pay off for investors and for students. Educational technology has already had some high-profile bankruptcies. Investors and foundations have taken some hits. Justin Reich is an educational research fellow at Harvard X. He thinks many of the companies getting venture capital money just aren't that revolutionary. Take, for example, online games with multiple choice answers.
Oh, I know what this is. This is a worksheet. You know, it's randomized and it's on a computer, but this, I got worksheet problems. I know what these things are.
Or apps that hand out digital badges.
Oh, those are stickers. You know, Mrs. Truesdell in the third grade gave me stickers. I recognize these things.
A lot of online classes are just teachers teaching in front of a board. Not that transformative.
If what we're hoping to have happen is to have there be really profound changes in the way we prepare people for an extraordinarily complicated society, then paving old cow paths is not going to be the way to accomplish that.
He thinks venture capital needs to look beyond what's sexy and focus a little more on substance. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
And if you want to see where all that venture capital's going, we've got a cool infographic on our website along with a timeline of the history of educational tech. That's at marketplace.org. There are still 3 weeks till it's officially summer, but the signs are already here. The iced coffee's brewing, the lawnmowers are mowing, and yes, those big summer blockbusters are filling the theaters. Serious and Somber is out, car chases, explosions, and mutant superheroes are in. Wesley Morris is Grantland's film critic. Hey, Wesley.
Hi, David. How are you?
What do we have to look forward to this summer? What are the let's start with the big movies. What's coming down the pike?
Big movies? Well, it's summer. Everything's big. Let's see. I mean, there's another Transformers movie. Everything is another, by the way. It's either a sequel or part of a franchise, which is technically a sequel. We have a movie by the Wachowski brothers, which this is an original film called Jupiter Rising with Mila Kunis and Channing Tatum. It's nice to see them back in the summer with a giant, expensive movie. Who knows whether it will be good? But it seems that people are rooting for it to fail. I don't like that. There's only one woman involved in making a movie this summer from the directing standpoint, and that is Lana Wachowski. So I am at least rooting for it to work so that more women get to make summer movies.
So if people want to go to the movies to see women in movies, why do we have only one woman directing a movie this summer? What's the reason for that?
Part of this is this sort of pervasive idea that there's a particular kind of movie that women make. There were two things that happened that people assumed would point to bigger changes in the way movies were made. One of them was Catherine Bigelow and The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. And the other was Bridesmaids, which was directed by a man but written by two women. I think all of the positive aspects of both those films, I would argue, have trickled down to television. I think there are many more women involved in TV production, making really good shows of many different types. And the movies have sort of been left to men, I would say also. I mean, I'm not saying that women are turning down opportunities to make good movies. I'm just saying that there are more opportunities in television for women to do interesting, creative things that aren't beholden to the set of rules that releasing a movie between the months of April and August would limit a woman to.
Yeah, it's funny. This is sort of an annual tradition for us. I realized we were talking about summer movies last year, and I think the theme for that conversation, so much as there was one, was about how sequels were all the rage last year. So sequels and then just multiples, I suppose. That hasn't changed, it sounds like.
If you look at even 10 years ago and what was released in the summer 10 years ago, you had a lot more movies starring adult people not in tights, which is a big deal. But a lot of those movies either weren't good or they didn't connect with audiences. And so the movie release schedule for the summer got a lot safer. And to the studio's credit, they were hits. And so there's not much of an incentive to change something if it's not broken. But I think that the response to the Spider-Man movie, Amazing Spider-Man 2, has been really heartening, at least for me, because I've been complaining about this for 10 years. So it's interesting to see moviegoers kind of get to a point where they're getting a little bit fed up with this idea of being expected to go see something because it's starring a superhero or based on a comic book. I think that people are really going to be ready for something new.
Wesley Morris, film critic for Grantland. Wesley, thanks very much.
Thanks, David. Have a great weekend.
Coming up, the terry cloth uniform, how the brand Juicy Couture got started.
At the beginning, what's crazy is that everything we made, every bit of cotton, everything came from the U.S., came from the Carolinas.
I bet you weren't expecting that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average bumped up 65 points, a third of 1%, to end at 16,698. The NASDAQ rose 22 points, half a percent, to 4247. And the S&P 500 gained 10 points, half a percent, to close at 1920. Apple shined up nearly 2% on news of its $3 billion purchase of Beats Electronics, and it was a good day for healthcare stocks. Merck climbed more than 2% on renewed promise from its cancer-fighting drug. Biogen pumped up 3.6% after an analyst upgrade. Overseas, the major European markets remained largely unchanged. Japan's Nikkei index was flat. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.46%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for April. The first Indianapolis 500 took place on May 30th, 1911. Ray Haroon won in his single-seat car. He used what may have been the first rear-view mirror in place of a spotter. And some folks celebrate National Mint Julep Day. Luckily, it falls at the end of the week. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. College campuses are under more scrutiny than ever when it comes to the safety of their students. There are those terrible attacks over the weekend targeting female students at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Over 50 colleges are under Title IX investigations for allegedly mishandling sexual assault claims. And there's a new White House task force pushing campuses to do more. Annie Baxter looks at how much the safety of college campuses influences kids when they're deciding where to go to school.
Over the past few months, lots of schools have gotten bad press for their handling of sexual assaults on campus. The U.S. Department of Education published the names of about 60 schools it's investigating, and the women's advocacy group Ultraviolet launched ad campaigns against Harvard, Dartmouth, and other universities over their handling of campus assaults.
Where we're coming from is just a place of acknowledging, right, that many colleges have completely failed their students on this issue.
Ultraviolet co-founder Shauna Thomas believes her group helped steer prospective students away from Dartmouth. Applications to the school dropped 14% this year. Dartmouth says the decline had to do with changing demographics, among other things. Peter Lake is an expert on campus safety. He says application and enrollment levels rise and fall for all sorts of reasons. And Lake says it would be tough to single out the role campus safety is playing.
Everyone is watching to see just how sensitive the consumers of higher education are to safety issues.
Are you going to be going to college somewhere this fall?
At a McDonald's in St. Paul, Minnesota, a group of high school seniors says safety didn't factor into their choice of schools.
Not really. I never really considered it that way.
Leah Tessima is headed to St. Olaf College, which is in a rural area. She thinks she'll feel safe there, but she chose the school for its biology department. Her friend Quayle Paw will go to a big urban school, the University of Minnesota. Paw is nervous about it. She says her parents are too.
Because my parents are really concerned about the whole safety thing, so they're going to let me come home whenever I feel like it.
Paw says she hasn't checked out the university's reputation for handling assaults. Several groups are pressuring college ranking services, like the Princeton Review, to factor campus safety into their rankings. The Princeton Review says not all that information is public, though, and there'd be no uniform way to report it. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
There's a bidding war afoot for the Hillshire Brands Company, which you may know as the maker of Jimmy Dean sausage, ballpark hot dogs, and Golden Island jerky. Well, meat processor Tyson Foods swept in with a bid of $50 a share today, topping a recent offer from rival Pilgrim's Pride, the second largest chicken producer in the world. So why are meat products suddenly such a hot commodity? Kate Davidson reports.
Hillshire seems to be king of the prom. Slightly beefy, but also heavy into pork products and prepared meats. Analyst Hester Jen with Ibis World says the companies wooing Hillshire have one thing on their minds.
The main driver of all these offers that are being made to purchase Hillshire right now is the increasing price for beef, pork, chicken.
Tyson and Pilgrim's Pride are meat processors, and they've got a problem if costs are volatile and margins low. Take those packages of Tyson chicken in the refrigerated section.
In that part of the store, you don't get a premium price.
Rob Mosco is a senior analyst at Credit Suisse, which has investments in the sector.
Because you're not doing that much to the chicken other than putting it on a tray and cutting it up.
Enter Hillshire with a portfolio of value-added products with higher margins. Kevin Dreyer is a portfolio manager at Gabelli Funds.
You'd pay more for a prepackaged frozen Jimmy Dean sausage sandwich on a croissant
than you would for a more basic meat product. So Hillshire's wooers want to diversify and move up the value chain. But to go back to the prom analogy, Hillshire recently asked someone else to dance, a packaged foods company called Pinnacle. Hillshire wants to diversify, too.
So if that deal were consummated, that would probably make it much more difficult for Hillshire to be acquired.
So it's make-or-break time before Hillshire pins his corsage on another company. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
In the early 2000s, the aughts, if you prefer, the tracksuit was everywhere, specifically the Juicy Couture tracksuit. You know what I'm talking about. It was velour, and it had the word juicy emblazoned on the backside. Well, that tracksuit epitomized this trend in fashion called casual luxury. Well, the story of that tracksuit, of Juicy Couture the brand, and the ultimate sale of that brand to Liz Claiborne is the subject of a new book by Juicy's creators, Pamela Skeist-Levy and Gila Nash-Taylor. Pam and Gila, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
You know, I think that what so many people identify with the Juicy brand is the tracksuit, of course. But there is much that came before that. You guys started with maternity wear.
We did. We did. Because I think anybody that starts a business starts it out of a need for something that they feel they don't have. And when I was pregnant with my son, Travis, going around to maternity stores and seeing what was available to wear was just totally not an option for me. So we started a maternity line based off a pair of old vintage jeans of my husband's that I turned into, put a soda panel on and turned into a very cool alternative to what was available.
And this sort of encapsulates how you guys got started. I mean, you say the subtitle of the book is you got started with $200, but you very much built this from the ground up.
We did. We really did start with $200. That's what we did. We went downtown to a rag house and picked through just dumpster diving through a mountain of filthy jeans and with a tape measure. And that's how we started.
And we had a blast.
So how'd you go from maternity wear to the company that we know as Juicy Couture?
We always knew that we wanted to go into business and make ready-to-wear. Gila and I are petite. We wanted to really make the perfect T-shirt.
You use the adjective buttery a lot, right?
Buttery, 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 soft. We love soft. The fabric has to be amazingly soft. And it didn't exist. So we set out to create the perfect T-shirt. We're really not into disposable clothes. We love things to last, get better and better as you wash them.
How did you get those shirts out there? This was you pounding the pavement, driving in a van, trying to sell these shirts where you could.
Well, the van story was not, I mean, getting them sold. When we started, it was really before the internet. Our label was Made in the Glamorous USA.
No outsourcing, right?
At the beginning, what's crazy is that everything we made, every bit of cotton, everything came from the U.S., came from the Carolinas. Today, you couldn't do that. You just couldn't. None of those mills even exist anymore. And we wanted to make in the Glamorous USA. We wanted to support Los Angeles and our community. And it was great.
Making offshore was too scary. It was too far away. We needed to tweak samples, try them on, make sure they fit amazingly well.
I wanted to ask you about that part of the wild ride where things are just growing so quickly. And I mean, I think you guys admit that it's kind of getting out of control. You've kind of losing a grip on, you know, being able to go down to that warehouse and feel different fabrics or look at dyes. I mean, the thing is taking off. What was that like?
It was super exciting and it was scary, too. We felt like we needed someone to partner with to take us to the next level.
Our growth was astronomical. And even when we sold to Liz Claiborne and they were like, oh, no, 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 we can hit. It's nothing. Even they were just floored by the growth. I mean, you hit these walls when you're growing a business. And we were at one of these walls.
I got to think that when you sell a company, when you sell a brand like this, that you have to kind of look back on that as a moment in time. And I wonder if since that happened, you know, you continue to follow, you know, what Juicy Couture is up to. If you walk by a store, if you're compelled to peek in, if not go in. I mean, what's your relationship like to the brand now?
You know, the brand is something that is not autobiographical anymore. And we're really focusing on our new brand, Pam and Gila, and just making clothes we are obsessed with.
When we left, the new CEO was someone that we basically did not see eye to eye with. Our contract was up. So for me, I had a hard time. I didn't walk into a Juicy store for a long time. And then we did try to buy it back for a year, and we didn't succeed in that. So, you know, I think the DNA is drastically changed since we left, but we want it to do well, and we want to always be able to love it. That's a hard one.
Pam Skeist-Levy and Gila Nash-Taylor, the authors of The Glitter Plan, How We Started Juicy Couture for $200 and Turned It into a Global Brand. You guys, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, while we're talking about fashion, there's a new trend called alpha-sizing. According to the Wall Street Journal, designers are doing away with numerical sizes in favor of small, medium, large, extra large, and all the rest. The reason, according to the journal, is alpha-sizing makes manufacturing easier, and it also makes things easier for those of us who shop online. Consumers won't buy two sizes, then return one of them, and men also seem to prefer it. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm David Gura. Tune in again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.